topic of this lecture will be the so-called holonomy flux algebra. So the question is, if you have connections and electric fields, as we have as a classical starting point, what are the good, what are the elementary variables, as we call them, on which to base quantization? P, we called them yesterday. And if you look up what is known about quantization of theories which are based on connections, the canonical quantization of theories with connections, then you will find in textbooks that there are good variables to use are so-called holonomies and fluxes. And this has been, in a sense, very much used in the early days of loop quantum gravity. In particular, to be mentioned are the names of Carlo, Jacobson, and Smolin. And there's also related work by Gambini and Pullin. And they called it the loop representation in the early constructions based on using these holonomies was called loop representation. And this is actually where the name loop quantum gravity comes from. So let me start deriving this. So the elementary variables are holonomies and fluxes. So what's a holonomy? Holonomy along a one-dimensional curve, say, E, is a group element. I call it A of E. It's a group element in SU2, which physicists like to write as the path-ordered exponential of the integral of the connection along the curve E. And when I write A without any indices, I mean actually A is AJ, tau J by 2 dxA, where tau J is related to the Pauli matrices by multiplying the Pauli matrix by minus I times minus I. So if you want to be more explicit, you can write A of E explicitly as the one, the 2x2 unit matrix plus an infinite series. And now a multiple integral from 0 to 1 dt from t1 to 1 dt 2 and so on until tn minus 1 until 1 dtn, a of t1, a of tn, where a of t is equal to a evaluated at the point e of t, where I assume that I parameterize my path e as an image of the interval from 0 to 1 into sigma. So this these kind of variables are going to be our first kind of configuration variables. The second kind of variable that we use are fluxes, En of s, given by the integral over surface s of the following object, Ea j of x, and then nj of x, and then epsilon abc dxb, which dxc. And n is a Lie algebra valued function. Function on sigma. Um, I will say more about the properties of these functions later. What we need also is the following concept, and this makes the connection with what Laurent told us, namely where these graphs come from. So we want to talk about functions which depend on the connection. Yesterday I mentioned that we want to talk about something like C infinity of the space of connections, which is our configuration for n-manifold, times vector fields on A. Okay, so we said that P will be a subset of this, certain subset, and the subset consists of a certain subset first of all of this factor here, which are called the cylindrical functions. Cylindrical functions. These are functions which depend on the connection A, but they depend only on finitely many of these holonomies. So they will depend like this on the connection A of E1 until A of EN.
But can A be have a cotangent bundle of something, some manifold?
You mean whether the phase space formed from A's and E's can be viewed as a cotangent bundle over the space of smooth connections? Yes, it can. And since it's an infinite dimensional thing, you have to involve a little bit of Banach manifold theory. But I will not do that here. OK. So as I said, we are looking at functions which depend on connections, but in a specific way. Namely, these are f gamma as a function from SU2 to the nth power into the complex number. So there are n entries in which I can put an SU2 element. Here it is. And the gamma label here stands for the following fact. This function is a function of the connections along path E1 and until EN. So it depends on a collection of paths. A collection of paths is a graph. So this is how graphs come in. Here's a simple one, which is a tetrahedron, but you can have any kind of finite graph. Gamma, E1, E2, and so on until EN. So this is how graphs come in. Now let me talk about the second factor here. So I said yesterday that preferred vector fields are those that arise from Poisson brackets. So I want to calculate the Poisson bracket, for example, between this electric flux and a cylindrical function. So let me try to compute it. En of S and F gamma or F of A. Okay. So I'm using the chain rule. So let me introduce some notation. If I have a graph, then I talk about its edge set. Gamma. And let me talk also about its vertex set. So for example, in this graph, we have here a vertex, V1. V2 until, say, this one Vm. So here I can now use the chain rule in order to calculate this Poisson bracket. And I get sum over all edges in the graph. And then df by dA e. Matrix element, say alpha, beta. And then I have to calculate En of S with A of E, matrix element alpha, beta. Now, using explicitly this formula here, this path-ordered exponential, and using the fact that we said yesterday that EA J of X and A BK of Y is proportional to, is just given by kappa. Kappa was 8 pi Newton's constant times delta AB, delta JK, delta of X and Y. You can actually explicitly calculate the result of this. And I leave this as an exercise. And one can explicitly write the result of this calculation as follows. So let me introduce some notation. So suppose you have a surface S here, which of course comes with some orientation. Let's say this is a transversal direction of this surface S. Then you can have always subdivide the edges of a graph into four types. The first type is an edge which points which intersects the surface, but points outside the surface and into the direction of this normal field. The other possibility is that it goes under the surface, like this maybe. Then there's the possibility that this edge completely lies within the surface. And then, of course, there's also the possibility that the edge lies completely outside the surface. So types of edges, I'm defining an edge type to be corresponding to these situations. And this would be the up situation. This is the down situation. This is the inside. And this is the outside situation. And given a surface S and an edge E, I define a sine function, sigma of S and E, which is defined as plus 1 if E is up, minus 1 if E is down, and 0 if E is in or out. And then one can calculate this. This Poisson bracket there. En of S with F is given by sum over, so 8 pi, it's a kappa times 1 over 4, as it turns out, sum over all edges, sigma of S and E, and then and J of S intersected with E times R J E applied to F. So this is the intersection point of S with E, which only makes sense if this is non-vanishing, of course. So that's okay. And R G of E is the following operation. It's equal to tau j A of E alpha beta df by d A of E alpha beta. And I call this the corresponding vector field that corresponds to this calculation, I call it y n of s applied to f. So, and I'm considering the Lie algebra, P that is generated by all the cylinder functions and all these vector fields. So this is a definition if you want. P is the Lie algebra. Generated by holonomies, by cylinder functions, and vector fields Y and S of. So now we have this classical starting point. We can now go over and construct our quantum algebra. But before I do this, I want to talk about certain automorphisms of P. Say it again. Dot F. Okay. Thank you. Automorphisms of P. So what do I mean by an automorphism? So we have this, a Lie algebra structure on our P, which was just to remind you, V, F comma V, F prime comma V prime is equal to V dot F prime minus V prime dot F, V comma V prime. So an automorphism alpha, is a map from P to P, such that alpha of A comma B the same as alpha of A, alpha of B. So in other words, you could call alpha also a canonical transformation because it preserves Poisson brackets. And there are, so this is just a definition. But now we want to talk about specific automorphisms. So remember that we had several constraints in this year. There was the SU2 Gauss constraint, there was the spatial diffeomorphism constraint, and there was the Hamiltonian constraint. CJ, if it was given by dA, eA, j, dA, eA, j plus epsilon, j, kL, aA, k, eA, l. And there was this other constraint, CA is equal to FABJ, EBJ. Now let me smear these constraints with test functions. Let me define C of lambda to be D3x sigma lambda j times CJ. Let C vector of some vector field U on sigma to be sigma d3x ua ua times ca. Now let also G lambda to be the following element of SU2, just the exponential of lambda j of x with tau j. This is just an element of SU2. And let phi u of x be the diffeomorphism, spatial diffeomorphism. Generated by the vector field. U. Is this clear? What is this? A diffeomorphism generated by a vector field? So if you have a vector field, then you can define a so-called integral curve. What's an integral curve? An integral curve depends on a certain starting point x naught, and of course the vector field. So these are the things that you put in. And it's a curve C, which depends on x naught and u, which has the following properties. If you set C of if you consider the parameter value equal to 0, then you get the starting point of the curve. If you differentiate the curve, maybe you cannot see this anymore, d by dt, c x naught u of t is supposed to be u evaluated at c x naught u of t. So it's the curve which is all the time tangential to the vector field along the curve. And these two equations define an ordinary differential equation with initial values x naught. And general theorems in the theory of ODEs tell you how that there's always a maximal solution. And this gives you this integral curves. And there's actually one integral curve for any point x naught. Now you just define the diffeomorphism phi u, phi u generated by the vector field x to be the integral curve through x corresponding to u with parameter value t equal to 1, say. So this defines the diffeomorphism from the starting point to the end point of the curve given by the parameter value t. So this now is well defined. Now, given any function f on a phase space, on any phase space, and the second function, or again, given any two functions, f, let's see, and g, you can always show that the operation alpha f of g, defined as this, 1 over n factorial, f, and so on, g, so n times, so the n-fold Poisson bracket of f is g. This always defines an automorphism. Well, t is some point on the curve. I mean,
yes, but you can choose one and the same probably for every point x. You choose a value, some epsilon, but then this epsilon could be smaller and smaller with every x, and your manifold is not compact. You've got a sequence of decreasing epsilon, and you can only work with the function. You need to have a finite cover.
Maybe, yeah, but this. I mean, you say that the endpoint, the possible endpoints may depend on x, yeah, maybe. But I choose some endpoint. So this is what always defines an automorphism. So now I can consider the following special automorphisms. Alpha G lambda of an element A in my P algebra is given by 1 over n factorial C, how did I call it, C lambda comma A n and alpha phi u of A sum over all n C vector of u vector comma A n. And the nice thing is that you can now evaluate this explicitly. So let me evaluate for the case that A is just a cylinder function. Alpha G lambda for some cylinder function turns out to be the following thing, F gamma G lambda of B of E1, A of E1, G of F E to the minus 1. I will tell you in a moment what would be, well, I can tell you right now. If this is a curve, then it has, which has an orientation, then it has a starting point, which I call, or beginning point, which I call B of E, and F of E is the final point. G lambda of B of E n, A of E n, G lambda F of E n to the minus 1, and alpha phi u of f is f gamma of a of phi u of e1 and so on, a of phi u of en. So this is the result of a calculation. It's not put in by hand. So what are these transformations? These are really the natural transformations that correspond to the transformation of a connection or parallel transport, how these holomies also are called, in a fiber bundle. Fiber bundle. So the connection is just pulled back, or in other words, the holonomy is just shifted to the mapped path. And these are the natural gauge transformations, SU2 gauge transformation that also Laurent was talking about. So this is not put in by hand, this comes out of a calculation. These are the transformations that are generated by the SU2 Gauss constraint and by the spatial diffeomorphism constraint. It's actually the natural action of the group. Let me write it here. Of the group script G, which is the semi-direct product of G, which are these SU2 gauge transformations. With spatial diffeomorphisms. And I'm introducing this here for a reason that I will come to in a second. So I should probably also tell you how alpha G acts on the fluxes or the vector fields. So this is just given by y at G to the minus 1 of n of S and alpha phi of Yn of S is given by y of phi to the minus 1 star n phi of s. So at G is just the adjoint action on the Lie algebra of SE2. So at G of any, let's say, tau j, which is an element of the Lie algebra, just G times tau j, g to the minus 1. And phi star of a function, like this function n here, of x is just n phi of x. So these transformations leave our algebra P invariant, and they are like canonical transformations. So now we define our.
Excuse me, what do you mean by YN of S? YN is the vector field that you have previously introduced.
I did introduce it as YN of S is equal to this.
And it's a vector field.
Yep.
And then how can you apply alpha g on a vector field? Because previously you applied alpha g on functions. How can you apply it now on the field?
Well, it acts. You consider the action. So you want to know how n transforms under the automorphism. So you need to know how the transformed vector field acts on F. So you compute alpha of this, which you can. And then you get this. Quantum algebra. So now this quantum algebra you get from P always by what people call abstract nonsense, because you actually don't do much. You just require the canonical commutation relations and the reality conditions. So the reality conditions are, of course, that y n of s is real valued, and a of e is SU2 valued. So if you take the bar, then you get the same as a of e minus 1 transposed. Or in other words, if I take the matrix element, alpha, beta, then you get a of e to the minus 1 beta alpha. So this is how, these are the reality conditions or complex conjugation. So the algebra P is also closed under complex conjugation. So now what we require is that we extend our algebra P to this tensor products of elements of P with this natural conjugation. I will not write this anymore, because this what I wrote yesterday holds for a general starting point of P. But what I will do is I will extend this automorphism. So alpha G and alpha phi extend to the algebra generated from P, which was T of P divided by the ideal in the natural way. So if you have an element alpha, sorry, for example, A1 tensor and so on, A of n. If you have such an element, then this is defined by alpha g of A1 tensor and so on, alpha g A n. So, and this is it, this continues to be an automorphism of this algebra. So the canonical commutation relations are preserved by this operation. So now we come to the representation theory. A. And the names to mention here are Hanno Salmann, who is in the audience, who started, who was the first one who started thinking about this, and then Jurek Lewandowski, Andrei Okolov, who's also in the audience. Some guy with initial T, and Christian Fleischhack, who's unfortunately not here. And so I will tell you not, I will tell you about certain uniqueness theorem, how to choose a representation theory, a representation of A. But I will not be able to prove it. I mean, the proof is would take me too long. So we can talk about it in private if you're more interested in more details, but I will only tell you a little bit about the idea. So let me first define certain things. The first thing is what is a cyclic representation? A cyclic representation. Of a star algebra A. So a representation, remember, was consisting of a map of homomorphism from A into the linear operators on some Hilbert space, is such that there exists at least one vector in the Hilbert space, such that the image on which all the operators corresponding to the images of pi is well defined. So such that pi of A applied, so any element in the algebra and the representation thereof as a linear operator makes sense on this vector, and is such that the image is dense in H. A representation is called irreducible if every vector is cyclic. Okay, this should be enough for now. And then there's a lemma, which consists of two parts. The first part is that any representation pi or h of any star algebra A can always be written as a direct sum of cyclic representations. The second thing is that cyclic representations are in one-to-one correspondence with states omega on A. So maybe I should have said here what a state is. A state is a positive linear functional. omega from A to C, and positive means that omega of A star A is bigger or equal to zero. And this thing here is actually the content of a very extremely important theorem in quantum field theory, which is called the GNS construction. GNS stands for Gelfand, Neimark, and Siegel. And it goes as follows. Given omega, such state, there exist, or actually, I wrote this already here. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between cyclic representations and states omega. So I just need to define given a state, how do I define the corresponding representation, the Hilbert space, and the cyclic vector? These are the so-called GNS data. So how do I get it? Well, first of all, one notices that J defined as the set of all elements in A with the property that omega A star A is equal to zero is left ideal in A. And then one defines equivalence classes of elements in A to be the corresponding equivalence class. Equivalence class. And this is what it defines pi of A, pi or pi omega of A. The Hilbert space, you notice that the algebra itself is also a vector space. So we can also think about making it a Hilbert space. And actually, the Hilbert space is given by H omega is, well, A, the algebra, divided by this ideal, and then completed. So I need to tell you what the Hilbert space norm is in order to define this completion. The Hilbert space norm is given by or the inner product between pi between A and B in this Hilbert space is just given by omega I A star B. And using the fact that this is an ideal, you can show this is well defined, that is independent of the representative. So the last thing I need to define is the cyclic vector. This is just the equivalence class of the unit operator or unit element in the algebra. Okay, and if you have the other situation, so here we were given omega. If you are given not omega, but a representation, a cyclic representation. So this is the other way. We define the positive linear functional of A to be just the inner product or the expectation value. Of A. So this defines. Okay. So now I can state the content of this uniqueness theorem. And then I will yeah?
I want to ask a question because I really don't know much about unbounded, but I have the feeling that if you demand that the whole representation of the algebra has a common domain,
where you can one vector is in this. The intersection of all the domains of this operator is one vector, is omega, at least one.
At least.
So you can check some cyclic properties. So actually, I think that's quite a great assumption. And how does it work in practice? Is it possible for a great algebra, you know, a very big thing, find if those are really unbounded operators, find such omegas? Because if you are dealing with a bounded algebra, then this is powerful machinery because you are simply searching for something. And this
I will stop in a few seconds after answering this question.
So he's trained by those C star algebra.
Excellent. Excellent.
Normed algebra.
Okay. Yeah. So if
already a second question because this related. This omega functional you defined has to be bounded, so the norm will be finite in the Hilbert space you defined due to this GNS construction, or not? Because omega could be an unbounded functional with the algebra.
It turns out that if the function is positive, then boundedness is a consequence.
Okay.
With respect to the first question, it is a great assumption in a sense. But there are physical examples where this works beautifully. For example, the ground state of a Fock representation, where you have A and A dagger, which are unbounded operators, is such a cyclic vector. So, or maybe I'll stop now and state the theorem later.
Before you erase, we're sitting here about an ideal. When you say